Hello, everybody. I'd like to call the House Transportation Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, February 21st, 2023. We're in the Barnes Committee Room 124 of the Alaska State Capitol Building. Let the record reflect that the time is 1 p.m. Today we have present Representative Tom McKay, Representative Sarah Vance, Representative Jesse Sumner, Representative Louise Stutz, and Representative Mina, and myself, Chair McCabe. Staff that will be assisting us today are Secretary Linda Jensen, Moderator Zach Lawthorne, and Angela Steffel, my committee aide. Today, the committee will be given a presentation from DOT on federal programs and the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act funding for Alaska. So in the room today, we have James Marks, Transportation Planner with the Statewide Planning Office. Also, Judy Chapman, Division Operations Manager with the Statewide Planning Office. Welcome to the both of you. Do we have any questions from committee members before we begin? All right, seeing none, Mr. Mosier and Ms. Chapman, if you'd place your approach and place your names on the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is James Marks. I'm the Director of Planning and Program Development for the Department of Transportation.
And good afternoon. My name is Judy Chapman, and I'm the Deputy Director of Planning for the DOT.
So, Chair McCabe and team, you know, we're really thankful that you all asked us here to present and give you some updates. The presentation we're going to give today is going to go through a bit of a cycle. It's going to look back and say what happened over this last year, some of those lessons learned. We're going to say, you know, what we're doing to prepare and looking forward over the next year and years to come. So in transportation planning over the last year, one of the things we've been working towards is this idea of becoming more agile and pursuing an agile planning framework where we can try to be more nimble in our response, not necessarily take forever and study everything forever for a very long time, but also have action-oriented and objectives embedded in our plans. So the first part of the presentation, I'll kind of talk back, do that retrospective, that look back on, you know, what have we learned about the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act? What are some opportunities and what are some of those lessons learned? We'll look forward, looking at, you know, what type of plans are we making and how our changes to our family of plans will affect investment in transportation over the next decade and beyond. And then we'll also talk about, okay, we know what some of our challenges and opportunities are. What are we going to do about it now? So we'll talk through what some of those specific things from the outset. IIJA is a very large and robust transportation bill. We knew looking at it that was not something we could do ourselves. So it was how do we partner? It was putting communities closer to the center of planning and transportation project delivery. And also trying to get more of this funding out to the communities. So this is what we're going to be looking at. And you'll see this wayfinder throughout the presentation to kind of point to, you know, what area of planning we're looking at. So looking backwards over the last year, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act didn't just give us more funding in the same apportionments and same funding categories that we got. It also gave us a lot of new programs. In addition to the new programs, it also gave a lot of additional direct recipients. So in the past, state DOTs, metropolitan planning organizations were typically the main recipients of these funds. Now, the Federal Highways Administration, FAA, Transit, have gone from dealing with 52 states and MPOs to over 60,000 direct recipients from nonprofits and tribes and territories and federal land managers that are eligible for all these funds. So even at the federal level, there is capacity constraints in trying to deliver on the promise. This gives you just an example of what that those new funding categories look like and who is eligible for those funding categories. In the past, prior to IIJA, this was largely constrained to just that top line, those apportioned programs. There were discretionary programs prior to, but all of these are new. So Bridge Investment Program or the Promoting Resilient Operations, that's PROTECT, that's looking at resiliency. So these are all new items in IIJA. Moving on to the next slide, this gives you a national view of what those eight apportioned programs are. And apportioned is a specific term. It is a statutory term that takes the base level of funding and it puts it through a statutory formula that goes through to each state and then from each state to each funding program. This gives you an idea from the national level of what those, how that funding comes to the country before it gets sliced up into individual states. About 48 to 50% comes through the National Highways Performance Program. Around 27% comes through the Surface Transportation Block Grant. You'll notice to the right, there's the two new programs, and that's the Carbon Reduction Program and the PROTECT Program, which is really focusing on resiliency improvements to coastal infrastructure, to twice-hit assets, things that keep getting hit again and again and again. In gross, over this five-year period of this bill, there's about a 32% increase in funding across the board. Moving on to slide six, this shows how this shakes out for Alaska. We wanted to show going backwards in time, but also showing a more complete picture than we have in the past. So one of the things that we've been working towards is looking at all investments, whether it's aviation or transit or highways, and what is the net effect and where we're investing. That makes a difference in how we're evaluating level of service to our communities and to our partners. Not all investments are going to be equal in different communities. Some rely more on marine and more on aviation, as an example. This slide shows you that over time, you know, we're seeing a significant growth in IIJA. In 2021, you'll see the hashed area. That is the relief funding that we got through CRISA and ARPA. So in the net effect of what we're looking at in terms of increase from 2019 and 2020, this was the FAST Act, we've seen roughly about $150 to $170 million in increased funding across all programs coming to the state for distribution. You'll notice under the federal highways section, there is a difference between formula and allocations. So formula are those apportioned programs that I showed you in the previous slide. But each year when the federal government passes their omnibus, they also provide additional funding through either their highway infrastructure program or through additional grants. And those are allocations. So that includes things like congressionally directed spending or the earmarks. That includes emergency relief funding. That would also include some of the other direct allocated funds that we receive. The two points to call out, the yellow are prospective, meaning that is what we're estimating because we haven't received all of those funds yet.
So it looks like that the allocation for 2023 is going to go down by $3 million. That's
Yeah, good question, Senator McCabe. So some of this is part of an annual appropriation. Some of this is reactive to the environment. So we received emergency relief funding for things like the West Coast Alaska storm and continuing repairs on earthquake response. So you will see that number change. It's not always going to be an increase.
Okay.
Taking another deeper dive into how the formula distribution splits it up for the state. This shows you that, you know, by program, and there's a lot of information here. I won't run through all of it, but I do want to call out. The thing to note is that the growth that occurred in IIJA was not level, meaning certain programs received larger increases, some programs saw hardly no increase, and then there was the brand new programs that we're seeing. The other thing to realize with IIJA is that we would have already received, assuming that the FAST Act had continued funding at its current level, around $2.9 billion over 22 to 26. So the increase that we're seeing in IIJA is largely that $559 million. So that's new funding over the life of the bill. This is just the apportioned and allocated funds. This does not include things like discretionary grants, which will make that increase sizable. We've received some good early feedback on our ferry grants and some of our port infrastructure grants that will make these numbers, when we're looking at the variance from FAST Act levels to current levels, more significant. In general, the national highways is about 42% of the growth between the carbon reduction program and the PROTECT program, which is that resiliency program. Those two make up about 32% of the growth that we're seeing in IIJA.
Could you go over the PROTECT and maybe the carbon reduction too? Kind of give me a broad overview of what exactly they are, what they include, I guess.
Yeah. Senator McCabe, or sorry, Representative McCabe. So PROTECT is a long acronym that I will probably go back a slide or two, that says Promoting Resilient Operations for Transformative, Efficient, and Cost-Saving Transportation. So what that means is it's really focusing on resiliency to climate change, resiliency to natural disasters. The information that program asks that we put prepare a resiliency improvement plan together. That plan is looking at everything from landslides to coastal erosion to beach nourishment. So there's four main categories of funding that the PROTECT program will allow. It allows for planning, so the development of that plan. It allows for the at-risk assets. So for the state, that is us looking at what we call our twice-hit assets, so facilities that keep getting hit again and again, whether it's by landslides or whatever other natural disasters. There's a funding distributed for environmental protection. So that's things like culvert management and water shedding. And then the last is what they call coastal community protections, where it's really looking at coastal infrastructure that's at risk, either from rising sea levels or increased natural events.
And how about the carbon reduction?
Carbon reduction program is new for not just as a new program, but also a new area of work for some DOTs. So this is really getting at all things green. So this is electrification of the system, whether it is EV vehicles or fleets, EV infrastructure, community charging infrastructure. This is items that can mitigate greenhouse gas and reduce that. There is some federal rulemaking where states are going to have to make a greenhouse gas reduction policy so there's going to be some new performance measures we'll need to make, and we do get to set our own targets, but largely the items that would be in that plan should be reducing our emissions. It does include a wide variety of different things, whether it's transportation alternatives, meaning like bicycle and pedestrian facilities, to green transit. There's a long list of items that are eligible, but all of them are for the purposes of reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
So a little bit further delving into that, I read today about some cities that are providing vouchers to offset the cost of the number one selling electric vehicle, which is a bicycle, electric bicycles. Is that something that would fall under DOT since it's a state thing? I mean, like Denver is given a $500 voucher if you want to buy a $2,400. The electric bikes are very expensive. So if you want to buy a $2,400 electric bike, they give you a $500 voucher. So is the DOT, is that something that the DOT would cover, or is that more of a city kind of, you know, urban thing?
Great question, Representative McCabe. I don't know the answer to that. So there's, it would certainly be in partnership. If it was within our metropolitan planning organization boundaries, we would have to work with them. The state does maintain quite a few assets, to the tune of, you know, 40 to 50%, in the Fairbanks or Anchorage area. So we are looking at ways, within those boundaries, both looking at greenhouse gas, but also on other areas of interest like safety and reducing pedestrian fatalities. So I will take a note to get back with you, if there's a what is being called a sustainable transportation team that's being put together on this effort to both develop the plan, but also identify some of those projects that can help to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and we'll see if that's within their purview.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. I was just thinking about, you know, ice roads. Could the ice, paying for the ice roads, fall under either the protect or carbon reduction in DOT's purview?
Through the chair, Senator Vance. Ice roads would not fall under those, but it does fall under as a new, it's not a new program, but it is a new eligibility under our existing surface transportation block grant. That's the second line you see there. We do have an upper limit on the amount that we're allowed to use, but we have developed a new state funding program and have actually just awarded $2 million. There is a slide further in the deck that talks about that program and which communities were awarded.
Representative Sumner.
So through the chair, the congestion mitigation and air quality funds, does that just go to areas that are in non-attainment status for like PM 2.5 or is that statewide? Or how does that get split up?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Sumner, great question. So CMAQ funds come in two flavors. There's the PM 2.5 and the PM 10. They do have to be spent in either a maintenance area or a non-attainment area. In the state, that's largely our urban areas, but like areas of Juneau, for example, like the Valley that have dust, or Eagle River.
Oh.
I'm not sure if that was me or not. Sorry.
Follow up.
So, yeah, for follow up through the chair. So, maintenance, is Juneau still in maintenance? And is Fairbanks still in place in non-attainment? And when you say dust, that you're talking about PM 10 there, right?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Sumner, yes, that's right. It's most areas are in maintenance. There is a new set of rules coming out from the EPA that's looking at reducing the thresholds that we are actively engaged with, the Fairbanks Area Surface Transportation, the MPO, to try to mitigate that because it's not contextual to Alaska. Alaska transportation only contributes, I think, around 6% to the related greenhouse gas up there. So a lot of it's wood smoke and other things from the inversion.
What do you think the chances are of getting the EPA and the DOT, federal DOT, off of that sort of relationship between DOT funding and PM 2.5? It's the Fairbanks case is a classic example, and I think the Mat-Su had a couple of days of non-attainment 2 years ago maybe, but what do you think the chances are of separating them from that idea that it's all cars that are causing it?
That is an excellent question, Representative McCabe. It's going to take support from the very highest levels. So, you know, we're engaged with, you know, not just state agencies, with DEC, but also our congressional delegation and, you know, the governor's office, and trying to really drive it home. We support, you know, the idea of greenhouse gas reduction, but there's also a nominal effect that we can have on it with transportation investments.
Thanks.
So with all of that, you know, in mind, you know, some of the things that we've experienced over the last year in trying to roll out the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, we wanted to quantify some of our challenges so that we could work towards trying to improve them. We have limited capacity for being able to directly influence land use. We try, you know, in earnest to be engaged with our communities, but we can't be at every community's assembly meeting. So there is a bit of a disconnect when it comes to community engagement and regional needs. This all lends itself very well to, you know, moving forward as a community-centered planning where the communities can be there at the table as we're going through some of these activities. The silo mentality versus team mindset, and this isn't necessarily just planning or even just DOT, but this is, you know, even across agencies. We have, just as an example, GIS, you know, Geospatial Information Services, architects and engineers in every agency, but they rarely talk to each other and try to coordinate. So this, one of the things is how do we get all the right people at the table when we're discussing these issues, when we're evaluating investments and projects. So, you know, looking at more of a team mindset as opposed to individual silos. Our legacy systems and our data practices are a challenge for us. We're dealing in some cases with information systems that are upwards of 50 years old that were our primary project management system. It was made as part of someone's, you know, graduate degree program, and we've just kept it. Planning holistically, when we're looking at an area or a function or a network. So, you know, this is that idea of looking at all modes across the system. So there's, as an example, some research out there on what they call a multimodal level of service. So you have a highways level of service. We're working through what that, you know, that definition is for the Alaska Marine Highway system now. But when we're looking at communities and gauging investment, it's that how do all of the modes contribute to providing access and filling access gaps. Our current regulations are onerous and outdated, so that is one area we are looking at, is a potential regulations package. We're working collaboratively with our boards, the Roads and Highways Advisory Board, the Alaska Marine Highways Operations Board. We had a great call with the board chair earlier today and talking about the path forward with that. Slow-moving bureaucracies and process, and this shouldn't be unfamiliar, but, you know, in all candid, you know, I work pretty heavily with the Alaska Municipal League over this last year as a mechanism for expanding capacity and out and reach. And I sent this list to Nils Andreasen, their executive director. I'm like, does this sound right? You know, is this the right order? Are there other things? And for him, that number six is their biggest one, if he had to prioritize. And that is largely, I think, you know, probably felt by most folks that work with DOT, is that things take a long time. Things take, it takes a while for decisions to get made. So figuring out how we can unblock some of that is going to be a focus. And also vague working definitions. And this may seem a little bit innocuous, but how we define things like urban, rural, or remote has an effect on what we're investing in, where the funds are going and being distributed. In our community transportation program, in our regulations, it defines rural and remote as separate categories, with remote not receiving a marine highway system service. Well, is that no level of service, or is that daily service, or is that service once a year? So it lacks content to be able to differentiate. So one of the things that we're looking at is language and how we define some of these things. Resiliency, how do you define resiliency? If we're talking with our engineers, which we have, it is largely looking, you know, backwards at what's happened in the past and how do we, because it's demonstrated challenges. But there's also a piece of that that needs to look forward. So do we, you know, possibly developing a climate atlas that can say what's going to happen to the state in the next 30, 40, 50 years, and how will those changes or rise in water, sea level or things, how will that affect infrastructure? And do we change the way we invest because of that?
Thanks. Representative Mina has a question, and I suspect you've triggered Representative Stutes too when you mentioned the marine highway system. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I appreciate all the different, the summary of the challenges internally to DOT, and I'd love to learn more about challenges with tracking the infrastructure funds. I did a little bit of side work over the past couple of years helping to follow the funds coming in. And so I know that AML and AFN and DOT have been incredible partners in this. I also recall that there is a request last year for an Office of Infrastructure internally within the administration to track all of these funds. So what is the status of being able to see where all the different funds are going, and is that becoming more of a burden, or is there any interest in looking for more support in that manner?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, that is a great question, and there's so many loose threads of funding and opportunity, and when we there's this phrase that's starting to be used in National Governors Association. I think they're calling it FOMO, or just this fear of missing out, because there's so many and trying to organize it. That's why partnerships with AML and AFN have been so helpful for us in trying to organize all of that. If it weren't, I can safely say that without AML and Nils and his team, we would not be in the position that we are with our discretionary grants than we would be if the state had done it alone. With regard to the new infrastructure office, I believe that office was in the office of the governor, and that was Miles Baker, the previous infrastructure coordinator, who was fielding that. There is a new acting infrastructure coordinator, and I believe that they are still looking to try to fill those positions, but that they are not filled yet.
Follow up? Thank you, through the chair. My big priority is making sure that we are maximizing the federal funds that we are eligible for IJA, and making sure that we're not expressing any FOMO on that. And so is there a worry right now, let's say if we have vacant positions in the Office of Infrastructure, that we might miss out on any funds?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, I want to answer this carefully. I don't think that we would ever risk leaving funds on the table, but we would resource it differently. So, you know, as an example, one of the new programs that we're going to be releasing within the next quarter that I'll talk about is this rural ports, docks, and barge landings. It's a new eligibility. We've never been able to do it with federal funds before, but we can now. That program is small and can be, you know, programs in general are expensive and cumbersome for the state to administer. So do we partner with another agency and, you know, expand our bandwidth that way, whether that's the Denali Commission or something else? So I think, you know, a lot of our work over this last year has been in expanding capacity. So now do we do more? We've gotten more private consultants and contractors on board. We, just within planning, have 4 contracts for planning support, communication support, grant support. So we're getting a bench. So I guess the answer, if I were to be succinct, is we're not concerned, but we are actively preparing to mitigate against something like that.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. On number 7, you mentioned vague working definitions, and I just want clarification. Is that within the regulation or statute or both?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, it's everywhere. So rural means a different thing in our planning regulations than it does federally, than it does within, you know, documentation. So coming up with a consistent way of measuring these things, but and doing it in a way that is true to the intent, so that we are properly classifying areas and items so that we can direct the funding to the right thing. At the end of the day, it's about making sure that we're making the right investment decisions and not, I don't want to say arbitrarily, but unintentionally not investing in rural or remote Alaska because of a definition or because of a criteria that says something.
Yeah. Follow up.
Follow up.
Just in the few statutes where I've addressed that in committee of defining some of the different communities, it is a challenge. And so I ask that, you know, as soon as the department has recommendations on how we can do that, I think that's going to help us on many areas, not just transportation. One of the questions that I have is, as we begin to shape these definitions for more clarity, is there an opportunity that it could shift some things that are already in place and kind of upend them, or do the definitions kind of have a start date when you're readjusting some of these? How would that work so that we aren't inadvertently shifting, you know, a project, for instance?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Vance, that is a super question and not always an easy one to answer depending on the context. In general, you know, these changes would be, you know, on a prospective basis. So it would inform or guide future investment. I say that with a caveat because the other aspect that isn't in this slide deck, but since you brought it up, is we're evaluating, you know, it, for some of these projects that have been on the books for years and years and years and years, what is the off-ramp for a project and at what point do we stop? We're hamstrung a little bit because of the nature of our funding being federal, and we need to go through and complete things. There's a fear, a real fear, that, you know, because if we stop doing a project, we have to pay that back with state funds. There is also the idea that, you know, sunk costs don't necessarily dictate future investment. So some of this is kind of an ongoing evaluation, but if I can clarify or answer your question better, let me know.
Thank you. I suspect there's some much further conversations coming in transportation. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thanks. You can continue.
Okay. So again, I'm Judy Chapman. I'm the Deputy Director of Planning for Program Development. And I wanted to talk a little bit about our family of plans, because we like to say it all starts in planning. You can't get a project built unless you do the planning to kind of get it in the mill and figure out where the funding's coming from, and then move forward through development to actually execute the project. So it starts with our umbrella plan, which is the long-range transportation plan, and that plan's federally required. It must be updated every 4 years. And it is required in order that we receive all the formula funds that James had mentioned earlier in the presentation. So it sets policies, goals, and objectives, and then those policies, goals, and objectives inform the strategic investment plan, which goes a little bit more into depth on investment strategies and et cetera. And then from there, we go into modal and system plans, and then regional corridor and area plans, And some of the outcomes of these plans then feed back up into either the strategic investment plan or the LRTP, the statewide long-range transportation plan. So it is a feedback loop, and we're constantly working on plans. We want the plans to be actionable and informative and not sit on a shelf, but actually be plans that, for the most part, have an avenue to get things done and built out there in the world.
Thanks. So I neglected to say that Representative Johnson joined us, C. Johnson joined us at 1:32 p.m., and Representative Stutz has a question.
I do. Thank you. I'm trying to be very respectful of this of this committee and not focus on my main focus, but on through the chair. Thank you. On this long-range transportation planning, you said it has to be updated every 4 years. Is that for every mode? So it would be for highways, for airports, for marine highway system?
Does it
cover all of them?
It does. It does cover all of them at a high level. I'm sorry, Representative Stutz through the chair. but it is federally required through FHWA, which is primarily surface based. But because Alaska is so big and unique and has a heavy reliance on other modes, it treats those other modes in the policies and goals and objectives for the entire plan as well.
Yeah. Follow up?
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. So have those plans been completed every 4 years? So say if I said I'd like to see the Alaska Marine Highway Plan for the last 12 years, you could provide me with a plan that had occurred every 4 years?
Representative Stutz to the chair, we could provide you with the Long Range Transportation Plan, which is that umbrella plan that addresses all three modes at that high level. The subsidiary plans, like the Alaska Aviation System Plan, for example, they aren't done every, or the Marine Highway Plan, they aren't done every 4 years. We do still do an Alaska Aviation System Plan, a long-range Marine Highway Plan, and we would like to start doing a surface transportation plan as well. So those are yet to come in our planning goals and ambitions, but I think they would all be very beneficial to investment decisions.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, can I respectfully request that they provide us with that plan?
If you can, if you have that plan and you can provide it to my office, we'll email it to everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That'd be awesome.
Appreciate it.
Of course.
All right.
Anybody else? Okay, you can continue.
All right. When we are talking with communities throughout the state about some of these high-level policies, goals, and objectives, it's just interesting that different places think the priorities are a little bit different, and it's not unexpected. So we had the following six investment areas that we were targeting in the last LRTP update, which were economic vitality, management of the system, mobility for all Alaskans, operation and maintenance of the system, resiliency, sustainable funding, and transportation innovation. So you can see that Northwest Alaska thought the top priorities would be economic vitality, operation and maintenance of the system, and transportation innovation, whereas Southwest Alaska thought management of the system, mobility for all Alaskans, and operation and maintenance of the system are important. So it just differed a little bit, as would be expected, according to how those areas are served by different transportation modes and what their issues have been with those modes. One comment that was made at a recent Roads and Highways Advisory Board meeting that was quite interesting was from Andrew Guy from the Anquam-Quespequem area, and his comment was, when scoring projects, maybe there should be a high priority given for having nothing, which is a great point. There are places in the state that really have very little, and then there are other places that have a lot of options and ability to get places, and it's cheap. So I think he was just highlighting that reality that we all know exists.
It's interesting that the every region, number one, was operation and maintenance of the system. So I assume that's if there's a road there, maintaining the road, or snow plowing, or... Mm-hmm. That sort of stuff, and also interesting, of course, is most of the people I know that move where there's no roads, they move there because there's no roads. So thanks. You can continue.
We are now narrowing our strategic investment areas into five different categories, and we are going to be providing or preparing some metrics in all modes that take into account these different categories, which are safety, economic vitality, state of good repair, resiliency, and sustainability. And this is also, these themes, these five areas, are finding their way into project nomination criteria as well. So we really want to get a sense of how are we doing in terms of safety across all the modes, economic vitality across all the modes, state of good repair. And so you'll see more coming out of us on that front as our planning goes forward. Okay. And I think we're going to get into deployments, and I'll turn it to James. Or was it?
No. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. For the record, James Marks, Director of Planning and Program Development. So I was going to talk a little bit about deployment, mostly on the new programs and some of this new funding. So a little bit of history. The IIJA was signed in November. The appropriation to fund it didn't come out until April. So that's already halfway through the federal fiscal year. And then FHWA, FTA, and FAA had to go through and write all their regulations and guidance. So it was very slow moving that first year in getting some of these programs out and timely. We didn't get guidance on the PROTECT program until practically the month before the end of the fiscal year. So being able to kind of get this funding through the federal system and then make a state program to get it out has been slow moving. But we are in a much better position now that all of the guidance has been released. They continue to write guidance and rules. The top section shows, you know, prior to IIJA, some of our solicitations or requests for application where we would try to put funding out to communities, and that was largely the community transportation program or transportation alternatives program and the harbors program. We do have a number of state programs that are either data-driven or data-informed, such as our highway safety improvement program, culverts, bridges, research. In large part, not only to new programs, but also to new eligibilities, we are releasing in rapid succession state programs to funnel some of this funding out. And, you know, very early on, we asked the question of boards like our Roads and Highways Advisory Board to solicit input on how this funding, how the state should use this funding, meaning we could program, you know, every dollar that's coming through the resiliency program, PROTECT, but there's also a lot of communities with a lot of needs. Homer Spit is rapidly eroding. West Coast Alaska storm devastated us this last year. So it's not all state-driven, and you'll see some of that. The Safe Ice Roads for Alaska, that was the new program that we put out. That is not a new federal program. It's a new eligibility that was written in. It met with large success and a lot of support. It's only $2 million, but it is going to go do a lot of good, and I'll talk more about that. Rural ports, docks, and barge landings, another one we've just never had the opportunity to really engage with federal funds, but we can now. The Community Bridge Program, Resiliency and Coastal Protection Program, and Sustainable Transportation Program. And then on the state side, we will be adding a carbon reduction program. So that is, again, trying to reduce the greenhouse gas that we'll be establishing a performance measure on, and the PROTECT, where we'll be using some of those funds towards resiliency to making our own facilities more resilient.
Representative Vance.
Thank you. Through the chair, can you speak more to the Community Bridge Program and who might be eligible for that?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, that's an excellent question. I do have a slide for every one of these programs subsequently, so I'll give you all the details.
Great. I'll wait for that.
Thanks.
So the Safe Ice Roads for Alaskans program, right now we're planning on running that annually. We may move to biannually. This is a new eligibility that allows maintenance on local minor collectors, seasonal roads, and ice roads. So once we were able to get that funding in and programmed in the STIP, we were able to get that the notice of intent to apply out, and we've already issued those awards. So we're finalizing all of the the paperwork, the MOAs, the waivers of tribal sovereign immunity, and all of that, and getting this funding to work. We've given you just the top 10, so you can kind of see what those look like. We worked very closely with UAF, who was, unbeknownst to us, already in the process of developing a ice road construction and maintenance manual for federal highways. So they already had a lot of the good data for how to look and evaluate these projects. And that wasn't for us. It wasn't just, when we're evaluating, it wasn't just about the maintenance. It was also about the economic impact. It was about connecting communities. It was about access to resources. And the Native Village in the Paiute, which is the Kuskokwim River ice road, there's a lot of communities that get connected through that ice road and get access to, a level 4 trauma center and a large, airport and so other things. So we wanted to include other things, and that was as part of that evaluation.
So I have a question on that. The little community that I live in, Big Lake, they have an ice road that comes from the state highway through the state park, and that's where it starts, and it goes all the way down Big Lake and across Flat Lake and all the way up to the end. And it does connect a number of houses and cabins that don't have road access in the summer. They get there via boat, just similar to the Native villages using the river. It's been plowed by the people. People just go out there in their plow trucks and do it. So I'm curious if that would qualify, number one. And then I'm also curious about what kind of, if somebody destroys the road, say by drilling an ice fishing hole in the middle of it, how does that, do we find them, or is it similar to a paved road? If somebody goes and digs up a paved road with their backhoe, how do we, is there any kind of enforcement action, or how does that work? And maybe that's too, not really in your purview, but.
Representative McCabe, this program has offered, us a new opportunity, but it has also given us a lot of challenges. We've never done a lot of this stuff before. Working through, these are Title 23 funds, so it comes with all the same Title 23 trappings. Even to the point where we're trying to get federal highways to understand the intent of the language, they have multiple definitions of maintenance, and routine maintenance isn't the same as, say, preservative maintenance. So they won't pay for the routine maintenance, plowing, but they will pay for preservative maintenance. So we have to make arguments to say, well, if there's fresh snow, it needs to be plowed to preserve the ice road because snow acts as an insulator and it could reduce the overall quality. So to your question, I believe we saw Big Lake on the list of applications. This list does go down. I think there was a total of 14 awards. I'm not sure if they got it. I can follow up with you to see if they did. But when it comes to private contractors, there's an element of risk that's involved with this. So part of our evaluation is looking at, has the applying entity done this before? Are they properly equipped? Because we're not going to pay for the infrastructure, the equipment to do it. And then there's the list of eligible entities. So cities, villages, tribes, and political subdivisions of the government.
So as a follow-up, they would have to be, it couldn't be just a couple of property owners on the lake with their plow trucks, it would have to be the village of Big Lake or the city of Big Lake or some sort of a organization that could receive the funds is what I think I hear you saying.
Representative McCabe, that's absolutely right. Yeah. At the end of the day, these are surface transportation block grant funds that, you know, we have to go through certain channels. They would have to work through the city, those local.
Yes. Yep. Thanks.
The next program that we're tentatively excited about is, you know, rural port stocks and barge landings. And I say tentative only because it's new. We haven't, you know, worked in this space a lot, you know, very extensively. We've worked with communities on ports and, you know, other items, but this is another new eligibility that we have through the Surface Transportation Block Grant Program. Right now, we're planning on running this program every 2 years. We are intending for this one to come out next quarter, so within the next 3 to 4 months, we'll see our call for projects. In general, there's a lot that's open in terms of federal eligibilities. It could be a lot of coastal infrastructure. We're trying to wrap our hands around how we would evaluate those projects, so trying to narrow it to rural port stocks and barge landings. But, you know, there may be opportunities that we could work in with either eligibilities or criteria once we do the final release for other types of coastal infrastructure. One of the nice limiting factors on this is federally it does, and this is, again, going back to those definitions of rural, does limit these funds to only be used in rural communities. They define rural in that section of law as not connected to the primary road system. So we are not extending the state CTP definition of rural, meaning connected to the Alaska Marine Highway system, so that more communities can have access to this. But some communities like Homer and Seward would not be eligible for these funds. Other communities like Sitka and other would be eligible for these types of funds. I will also just comment, you know, so each one of these programs, so like this funding amount that has gone through a series of different formulas is $27 million, and that may not seem like a lot. And on the next one, you know, the Community Bridge Investment Program is $54 million. When you're talking about bridge replacements, you know, there's the idea of how far some of these things can go. Collectively, they add up. And so I'll show that also. So the Community Bridge Investment Program, this is a new funding program, federal, that we wanted to try to direct some of that funding out to communities. You may have heard of the Bridge Investment Formula program. That program is largely federal program is largely looking at trying to preserve, maintain, or improve existing aged infrastructure. So, you know, when we were looking at this, one of the very nice pieces of this federal program is that they direct 15% of it to local and off-system bridges or community-owned bridges. That hasn't been very easy to do in the past, and it requires no match, which is sometimes a very big limiting factor for local communities to try to even apply to use some of these funds. So we are looking at $54 million going out to local communities for their bridges. These are any bridges that are on the NBI or the National Bridge Inventory. We're still working through our final criteria set, but the NBI is pretty expansive to include things like very large culverts are on the NBI. Even some of our ferry docks are considered or are on the NBI. So there may be some opportunities to do some things that we just haven't been able to do before. And again, you know, this is local or community governments, villages and tribal entities, and political subdivisions of government.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. So just for clarification, it has to be, the bridge has to be held within a local government on any level?
through the chair, Representative Vance, no, not necessarily. It can be. And for those locally owned bridges, there is no match requirement. But this is all community bridges.
Follow up.
This could be state-owned facilities.
So I have a bridge in the Nelchik area that is part of a subdivision. And we've been trying to get any funding possible. And the Kenai Peninsula Borough passed a resolution that said they were willing to take it on if funding could be found to make the repair. But once it was done, that they could take it over. Is just at face value, do you feel that this is potentially, I don't want to put you on the spot, potentially something that could fit that? It's not necessarily held within local government, but it is a subdivision, you know, within the Kenai Peninsula Borough.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, with the caveat that the bridge is on the NBI, the National Bridge Inventory, and they're able to get a local government or whoever, both sponsor and owner to agree and apply, this is the program I would point them to.
Follow up.
We would need to evaluate the bridge and everything. But
follow up.
So for further clarification, if it's not on the National Bridge Inventory, then it will not be considered.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay, on we go.
The Resiliency and Coastal Protection Program, this is distribution of the PROTECT, the federal program. We are looking at running this program every 2 years. This amount, is still under review because we have a number of state and local assets from the West Coast Alaska storm that we have a whole team of people looking at to try to evaluate, how to maximize this funding and make our facilities and infrastructure more resilient. It does include funding for resilience planning. So as a first step for many communities, we want to try to encourage them to do some resilience planning, meaning like what are your top threats and what are your top investments that you want to make, over the next 10 to 20 years. This is that looking forward so we can try to get communities to prioritize their needs and working with them to provide them a resource if they need it. This is the state's evaluation of our own twice hit assets. Again, that's that facilities that keep getting hit again and again and again. This is critical community access. And these definitions are pretty broad federally. So that could be things like access to hospitals, access to, airports and other, in critical infrastructure. We're actively kind of engaged with FHWA trying to figure out the extent to which that definition, that critical access definition, could be applied. Because right now they're even grappling with it. So lots of lawyers and calls back to DC trying to figure some of this stuff out. Evacuation routes is a big one for some of our communities. And then, as I mentioned, that at-risk coastal community protection, which has pretty broad definitions or implications.
So what would you say an at-risk, an evacuation route for a community? So we have some, I have some areas in my district that have had several wildfire in close proximity due to the beetle kill and other things, and so forest fires. And I have one little community that has one road in, one road out. It's the same road. And for want of about $80,000 in a dozer and 2 or 3 days worth of work to make a pioneer trail, they could have a second access out of their community. Is it that kind of thing? Could they apply for one of these and say, we live, they're up by Sheep Creek up north of Anchorage and they're trying to find a way to do this so that they have a second road out. Is that something that would fit this, you think?
Representative McCabe, I would think so, but we're still working through that criteria. It would certainly, so because you said that there's more than one, you know, we would need to figure out the criteria and the evaluation. You know, some of the ones that, you know, instantly pop into my head are like some of the North Slope areas where there is, you know, no road, you know, out. They've been working through their ASTAR, the Alaska Strategic, I'm going to forget the name. Thank you. Connecting all the communities with the goal of creating evacuation routes. So something like that would certainly be eligible. But I wouldn't say that, you know, on the spot that it would, what you described would be ineligible. So probably want to get back with you on that.
Okay. So.
Yeah, through the chair, thank you. I can give you an example in South Anchorage, biggest city in Alaska, the Potter Creek subdivision, zigzag road up the hill, up the mountain. Some of the most expensive homes in Anchorage, there's just one road in and one road out. So you can look at that one. It's right there in Anchorage.
So I guess what I'm interested in is the where you say twice hit assets. Mm-hmm. So in the case that I'm thinking of up in Caswell Lakes area up by Sheep Creek, they haven't necessarily had two forest fires go through there, but they have had numerous forest fires right in that area with the same sort of fuel and that sort of thing. And they're kind of in a curve on a river and they really don't have another means to get out of there. Mm-hmm. And so it's a definition thing. I'm sure you're going to say we're still figuring it out with the lawyers. What does twice hit actually mean?
Yeah, Representative McCabe, a lot of this does come down to definitions. So for the twice hit assets, we do have that one pretty well defined, and that's looking at facilities that have been hit two or more times, largely with the intent of trying to make that facility more resilient, because part of this is in new eligibilities, but part of it is in how do you make a facility more resilient? What does that mean? It doesn't necessarily mean making a facility bomb-proof, because it would be very expensive. It would take a long time. But perhaps it is creating sacrificial pieces so that if there is a flood, that it takes away only a piece of the facility that can be cheaply replaced or moderately replaced, as opposed to replacing the entire bridge, as an example. So, but with the separate piece, the evacuation routes, that would be, you know, getting into definitions. And does evacuation mean, you know, single, you know, egress, or is that multiple, you know, a backup, facility? So I can get back with you on the evacuation route.
Representative Vance.
Through the chair, with this in mind, how I understand the intent of this particular program is that we're seeing incredible coastal erosion, for instance, in my district along the Cook Inlet. There's been so much change just in the beach and property levels, and how much, Deep Creek has lost a lot of beach because of erosion, where it used to be a great place for recreation and fishing and had canneries all up and down. And it's just not possible. The real estate just doesn't exist anymore. Kenai recently received funding for their bluff erosion. Homer Spit, as you mentioned, is continuing to be hammered by more extreme storms. And we're putting in armor rock, and we need to be able to further that. And not to mention what we've seen in Western Alaska. So, from your understanding of this program being implemented, was it just kind of that basic level of just helping our retain the coast that we have without any, you know, particular structures, but just trying to kind of hold on to the essential real estate that we have?
Through the chair, Representative Vance. It's a bit of a loaded question. It's a little bit of both. It is trying to preserve what we have, but also, you know, some of this funding is, you know, going to be one-time thing. Some of these mm-hmm. programs like resiliency and carbon reduction, because it was statutory, there is an expectation that some of these programs will persist beyond IIJA. But, you know, again, with that coastal community, that's a pretty broad set of definitions federally. And, you know, we want to ensure that, you know, these investments are going not just to the right place, but also that is something that isn't going to be underwater in 10 or 20 years. But what is the right treatment? So there could be a lot of different things. You mentioned Armor Rock. There's, you know, we've been in a lot of contact with Homer and the communities there. And it is, you know, they need to have regular beach nourishment to maintain mm-hmm. the spit, which is the main access, the only access to some of those areas. So there's, you know, we haven't nailed down, you know, what each one of these things are. And that's, again, you know, going back to the definitions, it's how are we going to define some of these things? But there is a lot of opportunity that we haven't had before. But yes, the big picture, it's trying to protect communities from climate change and the natural disasters.
Follow up. So with this particular program, you mentioned some are going to be long term, some are just a one time funding. Do you know what this particular program is with the coastal protection? Is it a one time because $32 million is going to go awfully quick, or do you foresee it being a regular program?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Vance, I wish I had a crystal ball. So this is the federal transportation bills tend to wax and wane in terms of, you know, for a while there was a lot of different programs in Safety Lou, and then they collapsed them all down in MAP 21 to just NHPP, STBG, you know, safety and air quality. And now we're in this kind of expansion where they're blowing them up again. I think it will largely depend on what the administration and who is controlling the legislature at the time of the authoring of the bill in terms of, is it going with flexibility for states or directed spending towards specific causes? And that's where I would look, you know, as we start to get closer to 2026.
Follow up. The reason that I asked that is that you mentioned that some of the changes are statutory. Would you specify some of those? Because that's kind of where I got lost is what funding mechanisms are statutory that we will now see a consistency. If you could just briefly highlight some of those so I can kind of get the fuller picture here.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, yes, absolutely. Anything in this slide deck, particularly in the first couple slides that said apportioned, those apportioned programs are in statute. So everything else like the NEVI program or the Community Bridge Investment Program, those are all what they call apportioned, where they're only subject to funding every year as they go through and prepare their budget, their omnibus. So if they don't include that in there, then, you know, it may or may not get funded. It's those original apportioned programs. That's what's in statute.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. Anybody else? Okay, on we go.
And so I won't run through all of this, but I did want to include just a summary of what we're expecting to distribute out in funding over this next 2023 relative to what's been distributed over the last 10 years. So between CTP, which is out and almost double, I think our last CTP was around 56 or 57 million distributed. Our last transportation alternatives was around 12 million. Those are both 110 and 25 million respectively for communities to put an application in and try to apply for projects. And then all of the other new programs that I mentioned. So in total, it's $265 million trying to be directed towards communities to try to get some of their needed infrastructure improvements. relative to, you know, the $83 million over the last 10 years. You know, part of this is you know, trying to direct and get some of this funding out. Part of this is also, you know, trying to protect, you know, some of this investment. So, you know, we're looking at, you know, how do we make sure we get the right projects in the right place at the right time. So there's a really big focus on planning, both from the commissioner's office and my office, in being strategic and using the right data. So improving data across the board. But in general, about 220% increase funding this year relative to the last 10 years combined.
So if a community wanted to get involved with this, I have one little community that's actually on the Parks Highway, Houston, that had been neglected, I suppose, is the best way to say it, for years, mm-hmm. kind of at the top end of the Matsu or top end of Wasilla anyways. Everybody seems to be expanding north into Willow, and Houston's kind of on the way. So anyways, if they wanted to get involved, how would they just contact you, contact Commissioner Anderson, or and I'm asking because the mayor's actually down here right now with AML and stuff, so maybe he could set up a meeting with you guys.
Yeah, Representative McCabe. So yes, any time. So I you know, love speaking with communities and figuring out how we can help. At the end of the day, it is going to be their area planner and or planning chief that would be, you know, working with them on the technical details, but figuring out, you know, how to engage with DOT can be a challenge. You know, there's lots of different little on-ramps, and they're not always clear. The wayfinding isn't clear. So one of the things that, even though it's not in this slide deck, that I'll bring up is that, you know, we are working to establish a local government assistance office within my division, where we can help communities navigate the bureaucracies and get them connected with resource or funding or whatever. In the meantime, it's been, you know, working closely with NILS and AML to try to make all those, because there's lots of connections. But yeah, I could certainly connect them with me. I'll be at AML's event Thursday, I think. So if there's an opportunity to connect, it'd be great.
Perfect. Thanks. Anybody else? Moving on.
And I think I'll turn it over to Deputy Director.
Yeah. For the record, Judy Chapman, Deputy Director of Planning. Just wanted to talk a little bit about our strategic partners. Really, we couldn't do a whole lot without partners, and we're realizing that more and more. I'll start at the bottom. Federal land managers may seem like unlikely partners, but in fact, through partnership with them, we've been able to successfully obtain about 9 federal land access program grants, where DOT is doing the design and the work on these projects, and their bridges and culverts and waysides and wayside at the Copper River we're doing this year. So a lot of different kinds of projects that people really like, and we all support each other in the project and writing up the nomination, and then DOT gets. So it's been additive to our normal program, and really great thing. So in addition to that, Alaska Municipal League has been an invaluable partner. We've been working with them. We probably talk to them at least once or twice a day on various things, but we collaborate on creating discretionary grant nominations and reaching out to communities and talking through, you know, we're talking now about how to better execute the regional planning organization model that we started. We'll get to that in a second. And then Denali Commission's been great. We have a monthly meeting with them, and they are interested in becoming a partner on the Alaska Funding Opportunity, Transportation Funding Opportunity Hub, which we put together, and I'll talk about in a second as well. So just a lot of partners, and it's really, I'm not giving it lip service. I mean, we're really realizing there's very little we can do well without engaging in partners. I just had mentioned, I'm sorry.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, what about AFN as a strategic partner? I know they had a lot of the navigators that helped with federal funding last year as well.
Representative Mina, through the chair, AFN is an organization that we work with closely on at their convention every year, and we generally have someone on the agenda and have a booth there and talk. We do also have tribal outreach that we do. In two of our regions, we do monthly tribal calls and have any tribal partners that would like to join the call. I just did one last week with the Interior Tribes, and it's an opportunity to get the DOT, the Tribal Transportation Office of FHWA, and various tribes together to talk about maintenance issues, planning issues, and capital funding issues that they have. And what we're finding, again, going back to partnerships, is that, you know, the Native villages and tribal transportation organizations have funding opportunities that we don't have that can benefit the DOT as well. So an example of that would be Manly Native, Manly Tribe would like to allocate some bridge funds to a bridge that's an issue for us to bring heavy equipment across a slough to get to the airport, that's our airport that we maintain. And so we're going to partner with them and we'll pay the match. They'll pay, you know, they'll get the grant for the bulk of the work, and then we'll design the project. And so we're working on an MOA with them right now to do that work. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Next.
Yeah, so I had mentioned regional planning organizations, and this was something that that the legislature had directed DOT to do back in the 2021 capital budget. And we have been working hard to reach out to regional partners to see if there's interest in doing some regional planning that we can assist them with, but not dominate. So to date, we have two RPOs that have been created in the state. And we're calling this an RPO pilot program because it's not exactly formal. We don't have statutes that govern how these things are set up yet. But we want to see what works for these regions. And so the first one to sign on the dotted line was Copper River Valley RPO, which is a subcommittee of the Copper Valley Development Association in Ardor in the region. And they signed on August 13th, and we have a nice quote there from Jen Rosenthal, their executive director. And she said, you know, it's tough being the first. The DOT staff are helping us. We're figuring it out together. The biggest takeaway is not to rush in and to have your policies and procedures in place. And it's been really interesting being there with them. I sit on their group, their board with them. And but just as a member of a transportation interest, there's other folks that are also members of other transportation interests. And we're trying to figure out how to create a good working relationship, and then what projects they should take on. Do they want to do a long-range plan for transportation? Do they want to just give us a list of their priorities out of the statewide transportation improvement program? Do they want to start their own transportation improvement program, which is more of a funding plan that we would then take a look at seriously and comment on and possibly adopt? So we haven't really answered all those questions yet, but they're cutting their teeth and trying to determine what they want to do. And then just 2 weeks ago, FAST Planning, which is the Metropolitan Planning Organization for the Fairbanks North Scarborough urban area, they started an RPO for the non-metropolitan part of the borough, of Fairbanks North Scarborough. And so they, that's going to be interesting, and looking forward to working with them because they're super organized. They understand the federal planning requirements really well, and they're very skilled. And then Northwest Arctic Borough is going to sign an RPO agreement next week. So that'll be our third. We've also had interest from other ARDRs, economic development associations around the state. We've got some of them listed here. And we're extending the opportunity if they want to help, you know, help us with our area plans or even possibly do an area plan for us. We might be interested in seeing what that looks like. So we're trying to be inclusive in that.
So I assume that it just has to have another vehicle, so maybe an ARDR or something that you can funnel money through.
Exactly.
It can't just be Kevin's road needs repair.
Jeremy's Kate. Representative McCabe, yes, that's true. It has to be a approved fiscal agent that can receive federal funds.
And so what's approved mean, like a community council or?
If they can receive federal funds, and I don't know the ins and outs of that completely, but I do know 56% of Alaska is in the unorganized boroughs, so they're limited in those types of organizations. And, for example, Copper Valley is in the unorganized boroughs, so the Arter was the only entity. Since they don't have any organized city governments or borough governments there, that was the only thing that we could work with was the Arter.
So I wonder if they could partner with somebody that could. So say say Willow Community Council couldn't receive funds, but Houston is a city and they can receive federal funds. If they combined and partnered and made a Houston-Willow planning organization, that would maybe work? Or is that a bridge too far, maybe?
Yeah, that is Representative McCabe. That is a way to go. Definitely partnering with an organized entity such as the Mat-Su Borough, for example, which I'm sure they have a very large borough with a lot of remote areas and rural areas. They may be interested in creating one or several RPOs. We will have to see. Or a city government could also be a partner.
Okay, perfect. Anybody else? Okay.
And then I mentioned this earlier, but this was the Alaska Transportation Funding Opportunity Hub. All you have to do is Google it, and you'll come right to it. And it is a door into talking about your project transportation need, and then at the back end, AML and DOT will try to pair it with a funding opportunity. And we were just talking with the Denali Commission about they're interested also in putting their projects and their project opportunities in the hub, so that somebody could do this one-stop shopping and not have to worry about calling the Denali Commission, calling DOT, calling, you know, whomever else to try to find out if there's funding out there. But just go to the hub, put it in, and then even if it doesn't pair with an opportunity for 4 months or 6 months, eventually it probably will. And then if it's strong enough and could bring in money to the state, we certainly don't care, you know, who gets the money. It's about bringing in more transportation dollars, you know, to the state, and that's going to benefit all of us. So that's the idea behind the hub, and we're really happy with how it's turned out so far.
Okay.
And I think James had mentioned prior that, you know, the state has been partnering with AML and working hard on obtaining discretionary grants or chasing discretionary grant opportunities. And, you know, we've submitted over $850 million worth of potential discretionary grants. And we have been successful at some. We've gotten the PIDP grant for Cordova, Chinega, and Tip-Titlet ports at $28 million. And the rural and low or no ferry program looks like it's landing back in the state flat. And you can see the dollar amounts there. It's not small dollar amounts. These are real dollars here. And then we also were, it wasn't us, but it was the city of Kodiak, I think, that was successful. We helped them with AML, put a grant application together for the Kodiak, Russian, and Sargent River bridges. And it's just for planning, but they want to figure out what they can do there. And so we count that one as a win as well. So we're tracking what's being brought into the state in terms of successful discretionary grants.
So I'm a little curious about some of this, like the port infrastructure development. So what would be the criteria? I mean, not saying anything against anybody here, but Pelican has 88 people residing in it, and we're going to put $12 million into it. That's $136,000 per person. Why don't we just give them the money and they can fly? I mean, I'm being flipped, but I mean, what's the criteria?
Yeah, I would, Representative McCabe, I'd have to get back to you on that. I don't know the specifics of that grant program. I don't know if James might and be able to comment on that.
No, for the record, James Marks. Representative McCabe, no. Deputy Commissioner Catherine Keith has been working with our coastal communities and the marine highways on this, so we would probably want to get with her and get some information for you.
Okay. Yep. I'd be just interested in seeing how we develop the criteria for that. You know, the village has been slowly shrinking over the years. I think it was last census it was 160 60 people or something like that, and now they're down to 88, so about a 50% loss in 10 years. I do know that the FAA won't put money into an airport that is not cost neutral, so to speak, because they're afraid that eventually the city council or the governing body will shut it down. Well, it's as a state, we should be the same thing. I think I would hate to see us put in a $12 million ferry terminal, much as it's needed, and then have the fishing or whatever sustaining Pelican right now go away, and then they all move out of town. If you think of the Kodiak High School, how much money did we put into that school?
Want to think about that.
Yeah, not Kodiak, but Carlock.
Oh, well,
the Carlock. Yeah. So, anyways, I'm wondering about the criteria. So, if you have something that you could share, that'd be great. So.
Yeah, absolutely, Representative McCabe. We'll get that back to you.
Okay. Sorry, I kind of interrupted you mid slide there.
No. I was going to read through these, actually, and Judy Chapman, for the record. But I will, we are seeing some success. This is only the first year. We just got through by IJA, so we'll continue to submit more nominations as the year goes on.
Oh. Well, a whole bunch on this side. Who is first? Representative Mina.
Yes, I just wanted to go back to slide number 8 about current challenges. So I don't know if this is the appropriate question for you both, but going back to the top challenge that Nil stated at AML, slow-moving bureaucracies and processes, what is the department working on right now to be able to be more efficient? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Amina, we're looking. There's a wholesale evaluation going on right now in the department about being more agile, being faster, trying to cut through the red tape. You know, I mentioned it briefly, this idea of agile planning, but really it's happening, you know, across the board with project delivery. How can we get a project done in less than 8 to 10 years? How can we get plan sets out in less than 2 to 3 years for an area plan or a long range plan. So there's, I want to say, efforts going on across the entire organization, all the way from the top. The commissioner's office and Deputy Commissioner Keith, prior to her taking her deputy commissioner role, she was the change management director and has really fostered some of these ideas of change is good, change is okay, and being more agile and quicker. And I don't know if, Judy, if you had any other thing you wanted to add, but.
Yeah, I would just say that we're in planning, we have a process that we typically follow, and we want to make sure that it's open, transparent, and it includes the public at appropriate times, and we're not hiding anything. So agile planning can provide, or pose a little bit of a challenge there. We don't want to be too agile. We want to make sure that we're being ethical and transparent and doing all the right things. So there are probably some limits. And then, again, the only other thing I would add is the funding that we bring in comes with a lot of strings that are attached to it, and it does tend to bog down and make things go a little slower. Not to excuse that, but we almost need to take it outside of our realm to a different realm. Maybe on a national level to get some of those the red tape cut through so we can be a little faster. I think everyone, their hearts are in the right spot. They want to be fast and get things out quickly. It's just it's difficult at times.
Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, along the same lines as Representative McCabe was talking about, with the $12 million for Pelican, I see over here it says under the ferry program that they've got Auk Bay, but yet they just send out an RFP for the new, to pursue a new dock way out the road. So it just seems a little redundant to put a bunch of money into Auk Bay and then send out an RFP to build a new dock 48 miles out the road.
Representative Stutes, through the chair. Yeah, these are just showing, and I think you were on the slide where it showed, oh, okay, it wasn't the Alaska funding or Transportation Funding Opportunity Hub that is just showing needs, but this one right here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you have a good point there. I guess we'd have to look at that, and I don't have a great answer for you. I don't know if James wants to add anything.
Yeah, for the record, James Marks, through the chair, Representative Stutes. All the, the ferry grants, that was handled with, through Deputy Commissioner Keith and that team. So we'll get, see if we can get some information on, and when you say out the road, are you talking about Cascade Point?
Correct.
Then, we'll see if we can get some statements put together on that evaluation between Hawk Bay and Cascade Point.
Hello? It would be interesting to know if, in fact, there was any kind of evaluation or pre-work done before sending out the RFP for Cascade Point. And if so, it would be nice to provide that.
The chair, Representative Stutes, will provide that.
Thank you.
So that it kind of, Representative Stutes kind of brings up a point. There seems to be sometimes a disconnect between two different agencies. One example I can think of is in my district, there is a little road that is going to be repaved. It's a state road probably next summer. And then the summer after that, the borough is going to have to tear up a mile and a half of it to put a 4-foot cement culvert right down the center of the road to drain, to drain a huge problem child called Jolly Creek into Big Lake. So, I've been trying to get them together, and there just seems to be this resistance where they're like, well, we kind of have this plan, and frankly, it's the DOT. We have a plan, and we are marching forward. And, I know that Commissioner Anderson is trying hard to turn the ship, but we just need to be better communicators and find a better path so we're not wasting money such as the rebuilding the Hawk Bay Terminal and then, 3 years down the road. Another classic example is the bridges north of Willow going up to Talkeetna. Why are we building single-lane bridges? In 10 years, that's going to be a double-lane highway all the way up to Talkeetna. So we should at least be building the bridges big enough, even if it takes a little bit more money to, further our planning. It's kind of like the legislature. We plan 2 years in advance and then wonder why 5 years down the road, we're in the hole. So, anyways, enough lecture. Any other questions? All right, so seeing other questions, I want to thank you, Mr. Marks and Ms. Chapman. I appreciate you being here today. Our next meeting will be next Thursday, February 23rd, where we will be given a presentation on DOT and PF facilities and statewide equipment fleet. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn and let the record reflect that the time is 2:33 p.m.